Name, Jason Horsley. Profession, Limitless. This is The Limitless, the podcast in between. You are now listening. You can walk an island way and you walk all the rolling dust. Your eyes were staring at me while playing your guitar.
I came walking a long way just for another chap. Then I saw her in the crowd and I looked her in the eyes.
So, I don't know. I'm not into an official introduction necessarily, just because I've had you on before.
Yeah, let's keep it liminal. It's been a long weekend.
It's been a very long weekend.
Point out we're face to face because listeners might not.
It is an unusual situation.
We're all quite tired. Mm-hmm. My only suggestion or even request is not to be too heady or mental or ideas, partly because I'm really tired, but generally I prefer not to get too heady anyway. So, yeah, that's it.
Okay. So where to begin? Well, we had Jason's workshop, is that what we want to call it, last night, officially. Not a lecture, but a workshop.
Definitely wasn't a lecture, we can agree on that.
Yes, there's a lot of
exchange. Was it a workshop? What do you think? Was it a workshop?
I would say yeah.
Okay, so we'll call it a workshop.
Yeah.
Because people were bringing up things that people generally are, quote-unquote, working on.
Workshop.
Yeah. Yeah. And so it was definitely in that vein. And we almost went 3 hours, which it went by really fast, actually. It's sort of a time warp situation.
We started and ended in the shadow.
Yeah, and just the lighting and everything, it was all about, the atmosphere was really good too at the beginning where we turn off the lights and sort of defocalize, which is very much, yeah, a really great meditative foreplay,
what did
I
you
guess.
Get? Did you get anything out of that in particular?
The meditative foreplay?
Yeah.
Yeah. Because a dark room immediately changes your fixation, I guess, in a moment, and so it disarms you. In a lot of ways. And so coming back to whatever, we're conditioning the space to do a certain thing. And so that's important. Whether you think of that literally or just symbolically, it doesn't really matter. The mind conceives of it as it conceives of it. So those are important ritualistic things, I think, that are important for any sort of gathering like that. So especially one where people are supposed to open up, in theory.
Conditioning ourselves for space?
Both. I mean, you're conditioning the space, so you're conditioning the atmosphere, I suppose. You're charging it, right? Again, however you want to think of that. Is that literal? Is it symbolic? I don't know. But the space feels differently after you do a sequence of events. That's what ritual magic is.
Okay. So that's a leap. Because it definitely went...
I mean that's a part... Is that a part of it?
No, I mean, definitely. There was no...
No, not for this, but I'm just saying, like... No, not consciously, or not, like, trying to, but... I don't know. Ritual is what it is. I mean, it's archetypal to the human experience, and no matter what we're
so
doing, it's a form of ritual.
So, but that, I mean, that was an interesting challenge for me. Doing that the dark thing, starting in the shadows, mm-hmm. was definitely not conceived as a ritual. And so part of the challenge was how to prevent it from seeming ritualistic.
It didn't seem obvious.
Being ritualistic.
Right. I think it was just... I don't think many people conceived of it that way. That's just usually the level I'm thinking on.
It was sort of ritualistic in a primal sense, though.
Oh, in a very simple, practical
yeah.
sense.
Yeah.
It's an entrance to the space, as you're saying. And from, I think the main conscious motivation was for me, and therefore everyone else, to feel safe, to begin with. In a dark space where there's less pressure. That's, yeah. Essentially that. We all feel safe in the darkness, right?
Well, it's interesting because I don't think that everyone does necessarily feel safe in the darkness. I mean, I can speak firsthand to having a paralyzing fear of the dark from the time I was 7 until really like 4 years ago.
Right. So, of course, yeah, it's both.
Yeah.
And that's shadow work. Right?
Yeah.
But it is, we do have issues around the darkness and what might be in it.
Mm-hmm.
So what would have been more ritualistic is if everyone had come into the room blindfolded,
mm-hmm.
you know, into a dark room, and that would have also been much less safe.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone had already seen each other, and I doubt that anyone felt unsafe or less safe last night because of the darkness.
Right.
Agreed.
I think it was a way to for people to relax in that, in the beginning. I know it was a way for me to, and that was largely why I chose to do it, I think. Well, what can I do that will get over that initial bump of me sitting in front of a bunch of people, mostly strangers, them expecting me to deliver something? Because I can freeze up right at the start, and even like my face muscles and tight smiles and all this awful, the awful thing.
They used
to call it the toad, right, as opposed to the prince. And if that's there at the beginning, it's really hard to get rid of it. It's sort of still there in the edges. Everyone feels it at the beginning, and then it's there throughout.
Right. Well, I said early on it was that I sense social anxiety. And some people agreed, some people disagreed, I guess. But I don't know how you disagree. It's an unusual situation.
I don't think anyone disagreed with the existence of social anxiety.
Except, no. And he was the only one who said he didn't experience it. But he qualified it.
Like, sure.
Why he didn't.
He had been conditioned not to.
It's an interesting social anxiety, because I feel it is not risky, but if you acknowledge it, there's resistance.
Yeah,
it's like you're not supposed to acknowledge it.
Yeah.
Like it will make it worse or something.
Right.
So there's a feeling if you acknowledge your own social anxiety, you risk being exposed, because others will deny it.
Mm-hmm.
I'm oversimplifying it, but there's just something about the thing that doesn't want to be named, that the gorilla in the room, which is, we're all uncomfortable just being human beings among each other.
Yeah.
It's a fundamental discomfort.
Well, not just being among each other, but intimately.
Yeah.
Among one another.
Yeah.
Well, intimacy is discouraged in a lot of ways. Well, if not discouraged, it's consumerized or objectified, so we never get a real sense of it. So in those spaces or those get-togethers, it's just unusual. It's just not how day-to-day interactions work at all. Again, most of it is just very superficial, and when you don't, when you try to be unsuperficial, it's just, it's awkward in a lot of ways. Because except outside like your circle of friends or whatever, especially with strangers.
Mm-hmm.
Or if, like, some of those people, you go into a situation cold, like Misty and I kind of knew what we were getting into. But
did you like the naked feeling?
Do I like it?
Did you feel like it actually...
I like it in that I appreciate what it's doing for me, but it doesn't mean I don't feel awkward in the process. But I accept it, and I like... Don't people like roller coasters? Because it creates sort of a rush or something. So it's not necessarily a rush, but I know that... it's putting me in a space where I'm reorienting my comfort zone or something like that. So it's a practice in terms of being queasy and learning how to move with like queasy emotions.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's a good practice
that's shadow workshop. Yeah. Sounds like that.
Yeah.
Learning how to move while you're nauseous. And not projectile vomit on the person next to you. Where is our barf bag?
So I feel like it creates a similar unease. It's, you know, it's not necessarily, it's not there for the rush, but it definitely creates a similar unease to being on like a ride or something. It's just something we're not outside of certain, our minds aren't used to. But then, okay. Proper wait time.
What was that smile?
I don't know, I'm just like thinking, I'm just contemplating the dynamics of it, and like who was there and who wasn't there, and Misty and I mentioned earlier just the spectrum of people. It was like from not zero acquaintance with like ideas in terms of like self-reflection and whatnot, but again, people came in cold, so there's like certain people knew exactly what they were there for and other people that didn't. Mm-hmm. And so you had to be able to like navigate those gaps and find a common ground for everybody to like unite on and be able to discuss the subject, right? So that's like a difficulty in and of itself.
I feel like the difference in the levels of awareness, I mean, because we were all united in the intimacy of the energy and sort of the nakedness of we're all naked strangers here.
What is this nakedness then? I mean, like...
I just mean a closer connection, like instead of using the word intimate, it's like a closer connection to the energy.
Mm-hmm.
So, whereas we didn't start off being like, hi, my name is Misty, I'm so-and-so, I do this and that, and I'm carving for you my
So, but at what point did you or John become aware that there was going to be intimacy and nakedness, as you call it?
From the second you told me to turn the lights off.
Okay, and you?
I guess I assumed, again, I'm a little familiar with your work, which is you're into exposing... stuff just about that you're working through and so on and so forth. So you're used to being more open, and that's like what the goal of a lot of your work is as far as I see it. So in that sense, I sensed it, but because I knew you would be open to improvising, I wasn't sure what we were getting into. But when you asked everyone, why are you here? That simple question, right? So that begins a progression usually in my mind of like where that might go in terms of like the questions we might address, which is like existential.
Oh, you were imagining.
Yeah, I guess I project. That, yeah. I guess I project from
the things you
where
might have. You might find yourself.
Yeah, all these decision possibility trees of where it could go. That's how my mind goes.
But don't you feel like? So what I was going to say is we're all unified, and what I'm saying is that naked intimacy of strangeness.
It sounds
in the
like
shadow.
An orgy. You realize what you're describing.
But I just speak in the language of love. That's the physical extension. I don't know how to not sound like sex. So, but what I thought was really helpful to the dynamic was that everyone was on their own different level of awareness of what we were talking about. Yeah. For instance, Annetta in particular was like, I never entertained thoughts or questions like these because all I seek is happiness and joy in my daily life.
Yeah.
To the opposite end of the spectrum, myself included, admitting right off the bat, I am having a hard time being caged in my body. So for me right now, life is suffering and working through that.
Mm-hmm.
And then everything kind of in between, it's sort of, I felt that that was helpful to the dynamic of the group because it kept things level in a way.
The different levels kept things level.
Yeah. Whereas if we were all sort of, we can all agree that life, you know, is suffering, or to ignore all of that and just be joyous creatures hedonistically in search of the next smile and lightness of heart, then it would have tipped one way or the other, you know?
So
I feel like the difference kept us
afloat. It's a proper tension,
it kept us afloat in terms of the... in terms of riding the current that was happening.
Yeah. With the momentum that was going and going. Yeah.
So, I mean, another thing about levels of awareness and levels is, and that I'm more aware of, or was more aware of last night, is levels of engagement.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing about speaking, because you said that you felt there was going to be intimacy and exposure, nakedness as you call it, as soon as I said turn down the lights, I thought more what you said, that people would start to feel that when they realized they were going to have to speak.
Mm-hmm.
And I based that decision, those are the only two ideas I had to begin with, was start in the darkness so people feel safe and can relax into that and focus on their bodies, and then turn the table so everyone else has to speak.
Mm-hmm.
Because I've been in those groups before where there's a shared agreement to go deeper, not that it necessarily was last night, but I was trusting there would be. And I know that it's quite nerve-wracking just being in a room and realizing that you're going to have to take your turn to speak. So I thought, well, I'm going to feel nervous, I'm going to feel pressure, so let's share that pressure so everybody's in the same boat, and then I'll feel better. So, you know, enlightened self-interest, really.
Mm-hmm.
What's going to work best for me gave me an idea of what would work best. In retrospect, I think it worked best. I think that did work for everyone.
Mm-hmm.
I agree.
But essentially it was a, that was an instinctive thing of how can I navigate that transitional space from just being a guy going about his business in a small town where nobody even looks twice at me to suddenly being the guy who brought everyone together into a room to have an experience. You know, that's a difficult transition. It's very easy to slip into a performance in order to deal with the anxiety of that role, right? Of being cast in that role. And that's when it goes wrong, and when it's a performance. Unless it is a performance. Like, some people thought it might be a performance, and I could have done it that way. You're the audience, and now I'm... But I've... The last couple of times I've done something like this, I've found it doesn't work for me. I mean, the Mexico thing was, I was on stage, I had a microphone, it's a performance. Deal with it, right? And I was nervous as hell doing that. I wasn't nervous last night at all, beforehand, which is the first time that's ever happened. I got nervous afterwards, once it actually began.
Yeah.
Because the situation was tense.
Yeah.
Yeah. I love that, though.
Well, there's something to be worked through.
When the tension is palpable.
Yeah, and because working through it is really a pleasure, right? Once you kind of break through certain things.
Well, it gets me excited. Yeah. I guess I have the opposite reaction. Instead of shrinking and feeling like it's anxiety, it gets me like, what's going to happen?
So was there a point where you felt the tension broke, or was it a gradual movement?
I think after the very first round of questioning, after everyone had spoken to the first question that was presented, there was a definite, like, release. Yeah, exactly. An exhale, a collective exhale.
Right.
Yeah, the more familiarity. And so, yeah, definitely more comfort level after that. But...
Did you feel that way?
Yeah, well, because it's like, yeah, you're breaking the surface tension of the water or something. It's like, it's after the first breaking of it, if stuff goes in after, it's not going to be as hard. So it built the momentum, so that's always the hardest part. Like, if you're writing, it's always hardest to start something. So as soon as that gets rolling, people are social creatures, so even in awkward situations, you can sort of keep them going that way.
Oh, yeah, we didn't have any trouble keeping people going.
No, no, and that was really cool, because once, yeah, it's people feel comfortable talking.
I know. I do enjoy that we quite literally exhausted ourselves.
Yeah.
As a, I mean, at no point was anyone bored or trailing. Like, everyone was fully present.
So this brings us to another interesting question. It's like I asked you earlier today, or I said to you when we were trying to describe what it was last night, that the closest analogy would be group therapy. Even though that's not exact either. I mean, group therapy doesn't really describe very much, because every group is different, right?
Right.
But group interaction with a therapeutic end. And so, of course, that is a, that's a very private space. I wouldn't say sacred space, but you could call it that if you wanted, right? And so then there is an etiquette thing, right? What went on in that space was actually between the members of the group. I have to consider this now, seriously, if we're going to continue doing it, especially. Where does that bound, where is that boundary that, when crossed, makes the space less safe? In terms of us taking that experience we had out of the space into the world and talking
because
about it now.
Because that was such a raw experience going forward then. Like, what do you mean in terms of what we do with it afterwards? In terms of, like...
Well, I mean, just specifically in terms of talking about it.
Yeah.
Like, how much is that going to disperse the energy or the insights, let's say, that were earned in that space, or were achieved, or however you want to call that? And also, how much is it going to compromise the space the next time, say... That, you know, we know, like, if we do it again, we know that we made a podcast about it, we've actually talked about it, will we feel less safe in the space because there's actually that, you know, what's the word for that? That what happens in this space does spill out into the world mm-hmm. for others to know about.
Mm-hmm. So it'll make us more self-conscious the next time around.
Yeah, feel less safe. Yeah. I mean, we're probably all here, but certainly I, my guts are on show for all to see. I, mm-hmm. my inner life and my private life is my, my heart.
Yeah.
It is my, the thing that I present to the world mm-hmm. is my inner process. Mm-hmm. But there's very few people who feel that way. So mm-hmm. to expect others to be able to do that, or even to assume that it would be good to do that, would right. be a mistake.
Right.
That's true. Well, there is something potentially dangerous about having an artifact from an experience like that. Because it gives you something to hard fast to look at. So, like, we were talking about, for instance, the feeling of being there in the moment. And then at the end of that experience, you could ask, what just happened? And maybe you can't put words to it, but you have a feeling. Well, then if you go back and you look at exactly what happened and you hear exactly the words that were spoken,
yeah.
it sets off this whole other part of your brain that is purely analytical and...
After the fact.
Yeah.
Yeah, that can be quite combustible for some people, I think.
And it shuts it down. It's the butterfly that gets pinned. Then we no longer have the inner mm-hmm. subtle experience. It's harder to refer to that because now we've got the artifact that recorded it, right? The mm-hmm. recorded history of it.
Mm-hmm. So, right, yeah. Like you can emerge from it feeling like you're a butterfly and then you look back then at the thing and you're like, and I was just a worm shedding my... Exactly, and you're like, I'm not a butterfly?
Which could be a good thing. If you bust your delusion, of course, that's we're all for that.
Yeah.
Mm. Right?
Yes.
I don't know.
Depending on the day and hour of the day.
I don't know. I still think there's a little value in delusion. Not in the truest sense, I guess.
Well, it's process. Let's talk about process, and delusion is part of process. The process is getting free of delusion, but the process, you know, delusion is part of the process by definition. It's what we're working with, right?
But there can actually be value in the delusion as well, though, because...
Like a chrysalis?
Yeah. Or...
No, it's absolutely
like
true.
I mean, in the bubble, you know? Because if you're constantly... If you're too aggressive about that process as well, I mean, I guess it depends on your output. If it's purely for self-knowledge, or process, like the artistic process is itself art, process is the artistic thing,
mm-hmm.
like in your case, versus, like for me, in the past, prior to this year, in particular, have equated myself as an artist with the things that I literally physically reproduce with my hands. So, output. So, this dress I've created, this show I constructed is my art.
Mm-hmm.
If you're in that constant process of bubble popping,
mm-hmm.
the need to express in that physical way goes away or can change.
I feel like we had this conversation at the kitchen table.
I feel like it changes more to producing ideas, or at least like interacting with idea space versus physical space, right? The isolation, almost that idea of withdrawing. Not withdrawing, but taking that.
Well, let's just, for instance, my perception. I'm just speaking for myself in my experience right now.
Yeah.
Go more along the lines of now just being comfortable in my heart with myself as art. The creation of myself, the exploration of myself as art. But prior to that, my egoic understanding of who I was as an artist was directly tied to the things that physically came from my hands. That I could be like, look at this thing I created. This mm-hmm. is my art, so therefore I am an artist.
Sure.
And sometimes the process...
Sure, and this is a danger then, specifically for me, that, you know, what are my motives in turning yesterday's workshop into a podcast? Because that's my art.
Right.
that's what yeah. I do, is produce podcasts. I want them to be interesting and riveting and to show how great I am. Of course, mm-hmm. I'm only a human. So if that compromises what happened last night in some way, or let's say pollutes it, use a loaded term, mm-hmm. and perhaps even more importantly, if it compromises any future events, then that would be a mistake. Mm-hmm. Right? It wouldn't be worth it to do that. But that's a big if. And the thing is, yesterday was a workshop. It was set up as a workshop, not as a private
right.
therapeutic space. So it makes sense to publicize a workshop. People who couldn't make it, they want to know what happened.
Especially
people
if
who might
to
come
more.
To a future
exactly.
want to know what they're like. So then there's that. Now, what Misty was saying earlier about the delusion and popping the delusion bubble, that seemed relevant. I mean, the delusions being useful, that seemed relevant in relation to therapy, that if somebody goes to a psychologist, psychotherapist with a delusion and describes the delusion, the psychologist doesn't just say to that patient, you're delusional. Mm-hmm. It's not productive.
Mm-hmm.
Because a good psychologist knows that every delusion has a function.
Mm-hmm.
It's protective.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So it's a question of gradually leading that person to the recognition of the delusion. And then the delusion has served its function, then it can be let go of and dissolved. So then last night, it's always going to be painful, yes, but it needs to be painful in a way that gives birth rather than, you know, it leads to death or self-destruction. So just to finish this mm-hmm. saying, so last night, what was happening in the group, the way that people were exploring their own issues in the safety of the group, feeling not judged, that was a safe place for people to see the edges of delusion, you know,
mm-hmm.
things in the unconscious that they were able to acknowledge, let's say, the shadow were a little bit, because the space was safe and they didn't feel judged. Great. But then if it becomes a podcast, they realize that their experience is being heard by the whole world,
yeah.
and that's a very different feeling and experience. Then they might start to feel judged
yeah.
and unsafe even about what happened in
Absolutely,
the past. Right?
Yeah.
So that's the thing you're saying. They thought they were a butterfly. They thought that they were safe expressing sides of them that were beautiful even though they were flawed, but suddenly
mm-hmm.
the whole world's hearing, oh my God, I'm so ugly, I shouldn't have
mm-hmm.
been so open.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
That, I mean, that's a razor's edge, right? Because on the other hand, the world is not our oyster, our chrysalis.
Mm-hmm.
As in, if we're going to expose ourselves completely, it has to be unconditionally to the whole world,
mm-hmm.
eventually.
Yeah.
That's enlightenment.
Mm-hmm.
It's complete exposure every second, nowhere to hide
mm-hmm.
ever again.
Mm-hmm.
And that's
nowhere to hide. Oh no! Hiding places.
Terrible.
In
life. Terrible. No more shadows.
This is horrible. No more shadows. Ugh.
it came up pretty early, the idea, or just the flippant statement, well, fuck everyone else, it doesn't matter. It's like, put yourself out there. It's like, embrace who you are, right? That was an immediate theme that I guess people, I mean, we started discussing, even though we didn't fixate on it, it's something we discussed briefly. And it's like, did that have value? And it seemed like people seemed to think that idea had value, right? So if that's really what we're adopting, then putting stuff out there is sort of the essence of that philosophy, right? It's like, it doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. What am I worried about other people or not? Am I really, what am I trying to do here? Am I still just getting pushed and pulled by other people's ideas about me, or am I really here to embrace something about me as an individual?
Well, my ideas about other people's ideas about me.
Yeah.
That's what it is.
Yeah.
Yeah, like a meta.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because we don't, you know, just, if this goes out there, I mean, we don't even know what people in the room thought of us, much less, you know.
Exactly.
Listeners of a podcast who will never even know exist. It's all our own internal narrative that starts judging ourselves for our own, you know, issues.
Yeah.
Imagining what the other might say about us.
Yeah.
So by the same token, you can't just say fuck everyone or fuck those people, because those people, they're interiorized, they're internalized.
They're like spirits. You're haunted by them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So the sharing of trauma is the uniting, is the empathetic connection?
Is that a question?
Observation?
Mm-hmm.
It's the ground bridge.
It seems to me that, I mean, to share the things that feel most unsafe to share is the only way to get to intimacy.
Mm-hmm.
So that you, if you can feel with one person alone that you have nothing to hide, that you're willing to let everything be seen about you, that itself is hard enough.
Mm-hmm.
It's trust building. It's a trust building. It's people don't trust other people. I don't trust a lot of people. I mean, I think that's a common theme with most people's. Our sense of trust is probably
pretty low. Do you trust yourself?
I trust myself more than others, but it doesn't mean I don't know I deceive. I mean, I understand I self-deceive, but as far as the work I think most people have put into self-analysis and actual, like, deconstructing their thinking process, I don't think many people do it. Anyway, I forgot where I was going. But it was just, I sensed resistance on some people's part, for sure, and other people were more forthcoming, but I did, you know, something that struck me was one attendant spoke of, like, her feelings towards, like, the industrial system and what it's doing to, say, the animals or something, and then our circle of empathy, and how far does that go, and, like, what are we doing about that? Does any of this really matter if, like, that's all going on? And, you know, being familiar with your work, I know that you are more recently, or, you know, probably for longer, but you're emphasizing, okay, all we can know is, like, this physical reality and, like, what's going on here. And so moral relativism has its limitations, right? So if you go too far with it, everything's okay, and I'm okay, you're okay, but then we don't admit the dysfunction or the delusion. And isn't the whole point to dispel those things?
Mm-hmm.
So she brought that up, and then you're like, well, you know, you're putting all your value judgments on this sort of thing. And so you're in that sense, you're, I'm not saying you're contradicting yourself. I'm saying that there's, like, I'm wondering where you're going with that, where when you say, well, you know that that's a bad thing, the cow's dying or something, in this sort of industrial system. So you challenged her. So it seemed to, not again, not be inconsistent, but it was interesting that you went from that angle just to sort of make her think a different way, or what were you going with there? Because it seemed like what she was saying was very much in line with your philosophy of, well, we're here, we're, how do we actually, like, make discerning or discernments about what is moral or immoral, right?
Yeah, but she was like I said to you, she was seeing the world as a problem. She was seeing the cow thing as a problem,
mm-hmm.
right? Something mm-hmm. that made her, that interfered with her, well, I don't want to presume too much, really, but it seemed as though it was actually distracting. Her talking about the cows, I felt, was distracting everyone in the room from what was going on in the room. There weren't any, you know, cows being killed in that room. I mean, we weren't there to talk about social injustice. Like, if we were, as I said, so if you want to get started on that, fine. We'll have a lecture on MK Ultra. I didn't say that, but that was what I was insinuating.
But I thought that it was an appropriate expression of, like, just metaphorically speaking, she was essentially
but
just
she wasn't
saying,
talking metaphorically.
No, I know she was speaking literally, but like looking at that expression in that moment in the context of what we were doing, for her to speak literally about that felt to me that it was like saying, I'm trapped under the chaos of the world.
Yes.
Because she wasn't at peace with some part of it in herself.
Right. So then when I hear an expression like that, rather than say, let's look at the slaughter industry and see what's behind it, and let's find the deep context for why we're torturing animals for our own nutrition and what the consequences are, that would then become a very different evening, right? So rather than do that, I would turn the focus around and put it on her. Why do you have an issue with this? Let's look at that.
Yeah.
That, I think that's all I was doing.
Yeah.
So that, because otherwise she's directed the attention of the whole group on her issue.
That makes perfect sense. Yeah. We were talking earlier about, too, that this sort of, you mentioned it as an art form, this is your art, you put it out there as an art, and then we mentioned earlier in the day we were comparing art to science. And so there's almost like a science to a dialogue or what have you. And so, in that sense, I mean, is self-exploration a science? Is this what we're doing a form of self-therapy without any professionals, right? So technically it's not therapy, it's just sort of people talking with a sort of a leader dynamic. But I guess as a science is like, is this really what we're doing? Is this a methodical thing?
I wouldn't
say
a leader, more as like a referee.
Or a guide. I mean, just like any sort of whatever, traditional spiritual journey, there's usually someone leading that procession or something, if you go back far enough in time or other places.
I mean,
we
were leading.
Yeah, it's egal. I mean, there's an egalitarian aspect to it for sure. There's not like, oh, I'm like, the whole point or what you were doing was trying to you said distribute the energy, right? And so everyone is responsible for helping to carry the evening and so on. And so I don't know, I'm just like, I see it as there's a lot to this, and it's not just people in there sort of just venting or what have you, and the procedural aspect and the methodology of what you're doing is really interesting. And
I thought that was really great.
Well,
I sense, again, I sense the methodology from the beginning.
That we managed to spend 3 hours together as human beings, being incredibly vulnerable with one another, and not having excessive amounts of tangents where we're talking about the military-industrial complex, or the horror of eating animals, or, like, all of these different angles that you can get trapped in.
Right, so I guess
to avoid talking about.
So I guess what I'm getting to is like, what is the genuine benefit of this, and what are we accomplishing, and like, how are we approaching it? And I think group dynamic and navigating group conversation and bringing things forward is itself like a science and something that's to be crafted. And I don't know, I just, these sorts of things, like you said, group therapy, it's not necessarily looked at as in the best light, or it's seen as some sort of like, even stuff that happened with, say, Gestalt therapy is seen in a, like, pseudoscientific light, for example. Mm-hmm. So, like, where do you draw the line between what is a procedure that's based in sound theory and then just people sort of, like, rambling to each other, and it's not, you know, it's not accomplishing much beside that. So how do you mark that line in the sand, and how did you mark, like, the evening as a success? Like, what did you measure it? How do you measure it as a science or something? Can you even do that?
No, I think I can't do it in the way that you framed it as a science. Like, people have done that, and I say it was ironic or fitting that I had just posted about Wilfred Trotter, Wilfred Bion, the Tavistock, and all of that research they did a century ago almost now in group psychology. Mm-hmm. And all this stuff's been mapped. And I think it is being applied. So I'm sure that if Wilfred Trotter and Byron and co. had been there, they would have observed them and taking notes frantically, and they'd have a whole bunch to say about what happened. Mm-hmm. And I'd be interested to hear it, although it'd probably be better that I didn't hear it, but of course I'd be interested. So then we get to the larger question of what is science, because we were saying earlier at lunch, we were saying that, or I agreed or said that everything is science, and then I said except what isn't, right? So science just means knowledge, and science, I would say, is categorization and systematization of knowledge, of an experience, so that it can be applied. And so in that definition, religion is science. I mean, religion institutionalized, magic that's ritualized is science, art that is conforming to a cultural aesthetic mm-hmm. is science. That was the last sort of straw that mm-hmm. broke this camel's back. Even art, oh my God, you know, even art's a fucking science. There's no escape, right? Mm-hmm. So when we were talking about last night, that wasn't science. Mm-hmm. I mean, so far as I feel it was a success, which I do, it was that it, not that it can't be categorized by science, because science can sort of categorize everything. And so science could, like I say, you could analyze it and say this and that, this person said that and mm-hmm. then this happened and make it look like it was science. But the thing of value was the thing that science can't map and that can't be planned scientifically, mm-hmm. which is the transmission. And I didn't bring up the transmission, somebody else did. Mm-hmm. They used the word transmission, and I gratefully zeroed in on it. I said, great, let's talk about the transmission, yeah. the soul, let's talk about the soul's expression here mm-hmm. and now. And the soul isn't quantifiable. I believe it is not quantifiable. Therefore, science can't map the soul. Try as they are, and they might. Right.
Right. And I posed a question last night, but I'll pose again. Is a physical correlate, could we call the unconscious a physical correlate to the soul? It's as unmappable as
physical?
We can. Yeah.
How is the unconscious physical?
It has, I guess, physical, tangible physical effects. Okay.
It can be sort of not observed directly, but
definitely discerned, like dark matter or something, right? It's like filling in the gaps. It has to be an unconscious
element there. I can deduce that it's there by its effects. So the unconscious is where you would go to find the soul, I suppose you could say, or the unconscious in a sense is proof of the soul, mm-hmm. but I wouldn't make it synonymous necessarily. See what I mean?
But there's a binding between them, or there's some sort of relationship that they have to be tethered
for
one to manifest.
They're just the
tools. So the unconscious is a technology for the...
The unconscious for the spirit? And the conscious are technologies of the
Now you're bringing it to science again, because technology, of course, suggests science.
If we're going to use that metaphor or that analogy, it's just if the unconscious is a machine
of
a sense.
So, of course, this is tricky. And when I did bring up soul, somebody it was you.
It was me.
Objected to that too.
Yeah.
And understandably, and because with language, it's, mm-hmm. if you're talking about what actually can't be languified by definition. If the soul is worthy of what we associate with the term soul, then you can't really encapsulate it with language, because the soul is outside of space-time.
Yeah. You can just sort of throw a sheet on it and feel around the outer edges.
Right. So then, what was the question? If you had an experience of an aspect of you that you had not experienced before, and that became more tangible and experiential to you, then that is a success. Mm-hmm. That was my experience. Like, I became more in touch with my soul's transmission, or the soul's transmission. I don't even know, what article to give to it, but of the transmission through that mm-hmm. interaction. And I don't think that that is a scientific thing. Like, it's science, if science is knowledge, and this came up in a recent discussion at Rigorous Intuition, the alternative to knowledge, or the dichotomy that you could present with knowledge, is knowing. Because somebody presented rigor versus intuition, or logic versus intuition, like which is better and how they work together and so on and so forth. So I posited as an alternate polarity, because I don't think logic and intuition is a polarity. I think that it's one thing with two different mm-hmm. aspects. Mm-hmm. It just seems logical to me and intuitive. Uh-huh. But knowledge and knowing, I think that's more of a polarity, because knowing, knowledge depends on a knowing.
Knowledge depends on...
Knowledge is like categorized knowings. Oh. So you can have a knowing of something, and then you can analyze it and categorize it and make it into knowledge and science. But,
yes.
But it's no longer a knowing at that point. So the person can then, another person can receive that knowledge, believe it, analyze it, extend on it, but they won't necessarily have had a knowing about it. Mm-hmm. And on the other hand, the person who had the knowing that led to this knowledge base will have already moved on to other knowings.
Right.
So it's constantly in motion.
Yeah.
That the knowing of the soul in space-time. Mm-hmm. Where was I going with this? What was this about?
So all of the products of that is like the waste of the soul.
The knowledge, you mean? Yeah. Knowledge is excretia. I think there's definitely something in that.
It's just poo everywhere.
It's like snake skins.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
I think that's fair to say. And then
that's how I thought of time. Or right. How I was conceptualizing time.
The snake skin.
Yeah. Like people are just trapped. I mean, the idea of time is like being glued to the snake skin. As proof of the snake moving.
So is our would you say that the unconscious is someone brought up the idea of mushrooms, the idea of this giant organism that's, you see these sort of isolated things on top, but underneath it's all connected. So mm-hmm. are the unconscious states of people all connected, or is it the spirit that connects everything? So if we're going to do a hierarchy here.
We can't do a hierarchy.
There is no hierarchy.
Not for the soul. Okay. Like, that's kind of the point, partly the point of...
Wait, where were you going
transcending?
No, that's where I was going, so...
What was the question?
That was...
He wanted to know who's boss.
Who's boss in this system of if spirit is animating the unconscious, and the unconscious is animating the conscious, so that seems to indicate a hierarchy, but yeah, I know that it might not, so...
Do you feel that there's a hierarchy in the body?
No, it's a holistic, a hollow system or something. I'm forgetting the exact term, but
so
it's cooperative.
If we extend that model to the energetic universe,
yeah,
one system, it's all working together, and there's no boss of the universe.
Right, right.
Thank God. It's a demiurge.
But could we say there's an animating force? There's some sort of animation below this. There's the implicate current. Order. We brought up implicate order earlier. Yeah. So there is some implicate order. So
yeah, well, this is what we were calling the transmission today. Now, I studied with Deva Shana, and he talks about the enlightenment transmission. And I reached a point where I wanted... I reached a point where I was ready to be an evangelist for the enlightenment transmission, and it felt really good and it worked for a while, but then pretty soon after, to nobody's surprise, I'm sure, I reached a point where it didn't feel good at all, and I felt like I was trapped in some sort of belief system.
Right.
And that it was hierarchical and it was dualistic. Mm-hmm. And so I came up with my own term as part of that process, and I decided, no, it's not the enlightenment transmission, it's the embodiment cheesecloth.
And I laughed so hard when I read that.
Oh, you read
that? I highly enjoyed your 100 learnings from your time with Deva Shana. I thought that whole series of 100 posts that you did was amazing.
Oh.
Really, really good work.
Right, thanks.
Yeah,
sounds like a long time ago now.
Mm-hmm.
But last night I didn't want to talk about the cheesecloth. I thought, fine, I will call it the transmission. I didn't have to think that because I've gone through it now, and it's just whatever works in the occasion. So anyway, as far as what you were asking about, the source, the signal from the source,
yeah,
that is signaling through everything, through all of matter, you know.
But we're just the talking smallest. About like an echo, right?
No, it's a live signal. It's constantly coming through everything. It's constantly new. It's constantly recreating the whole of creation, every micro millisecond. Apparently, seems like so, and that.
But it's a feedback loop, echo.
Why? Why does it have to be that?
If there's a system, it implies feedback. Complex systems have feedback.
Because we don't experience anything the same way from second to second. So it's. Sentient echo? I don't know.
I like that word, sentient.
Yeah.
It's one I zeroed on recently. I don't know, is this complicated or are we just making it complicated?
Because probably both.
If you want to describe, you know, what's boss is damn words. So we're in a system which space-time continuum is the system, and therefore it's spatial and temporal. It's a time-space continuum.
Time is the boss.
Okay. No, time is the demiurge, right?
I'm just kidding.
Saying, I run the show.
I'm just kidding.
Play the rules, or I'll beat you. So he's a local
just
boss.
Pleasing the beast.
Satan is the prince of this world and all that stuff. Yes. Yeah, and he has, you know, render unto Satan all his saints and all that stuff. But the real non-boss, the non-local awareness of sentience, is outside of time.
Mm-hmm.
So, where am I going? So if you want to bring it, how do you talk about something that doesn't pertain to the terms of the frame of reference in which you're talking?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Right. How do you do that? You actually don't.
That goes back to my point about the value of artistic deception. Because you deconstruct, destroy the language, and try to piece it together in new ways that reflect accurately the new forms that you're feeling or that are trying to express through you.
Like James Joyce.
Like a pink elephant on parade.
Yes, our language is limited, but it's always going to be limited. So no matter how many times you reinvent it to allow for the pink elephants
language.
To come stomping through our rooms, it's still going to be limited. You can't unlimit language and it still be language.
Right.
So I think the danger in that, or the inevitability is we just kind of add delusion to delusion because we think,
yeah.
I figured it out, I've experienced the transmission, so I'm going to, you know, reframe the whole of our scientific understanding about life and include the transmission into it. But it's like Whitley and his aliens. As soon as you start talking about them and defining what they are, they're no longer it. They become projections of our own traumatic issues.
Right. Okay, so there's a pure transmission and then there's complexes. There's a distinction, would you say? Or are they similar?
Because all of the evidence of the transmission in being evidence, in manifesting as evidence, becomes fertilization. fertilization for deception, I guess.
Well, if we're talking about like this, the transmission, the spirit transmission, so is that destiny? Or is our complex, do we have these complexes that it ultimately cannot help, but it's going to be filtered through, and so whatever the pure transmission is, it never gets to us in the first place.
But it's always coming.
It's always coming, right, but are our complexes sort of inevitably distorting it to an extent that it's almost not useful, or is it always retain its usefulness, even though those complexes?
It's interesting way of framing it, and this is back, we're full circle now at the beginning, because I said there's no such thing as a light worker, because we don't get to work with the light. You can't use the transmission. If you could use it, it would already belong to the CIA. Well and truly, the horror, right? So you can surrender to it, surrender to the light, and then the light will do what it does with us. It will work on the shadows and we'll become shadow workers too.
Somebody asked last night how to surrender to it.
Did they?
Didn't they?
I don't remember that.
Sarah Ann? Maybe? How do you do that? Maybe she didn't ask. I think that you had responded with a surrender.
Yeah, because she was
in the chaos of the world. And I think she was, if she wasn't literally asking you how, I think that's what she was implying. How do you do that?
Yeah.
How do you teach someone to surrender who doesn't understand what's on the other side of that wall that they're surrendering to?
But you don't, is the answer. It's a simple answer to that.
You can't. They just have to find their way there on their own?
Well, I think everybody has to find their way there on their own, one way or another. That doesn't mean we're not influencing each other and
but the point,
strengthening the signal. I mean, this came up last night. In fact, it might have been the underlying or the core meaning of last night, for me at least, was, in terms of language, was that if we allow ourselves to receive the signal of the transmission, to be receptive for it, by being willing to surrender to that authentic expression of our souls, regardless of the consequence, being open and vulnerable enough to just speak and act the deepest part of us that we're able to, that strengthens the signal of the transmission. And others receive that. They receive our own transmission, and that strengthens their own receptivity to their transmission, and so there's an echo effect or a mirroring, and so the transmission gets strengthened, becomes stronger, the signal becomes stronger, and the noise gets reduced. It's definitely not Nietzsche / Neil Kramer's Übermensch.
It is, though, because it's the bridge. You're talking about...
It's got nothing to do with Superman. It's got nothing to do with, like, individual empowerment. Like,
No, but I don't think... And I don't read Nietzsche that way.
Okay.
I read him exactly how what you are trying to express. As becoming an instrument of the signal. So when he speaks of man being the bridge...
Yeah.
I think he really means satellite dish. But we didn't have that technology then. Yeah. So he couldn't say that.
I don't know. But a bridge is what gives. But why do you want to bring in Nietzsche, really? Because it's just the whole legacy of that. I mean, it's worth bringing up in the sense of, oh my God, this is how dangerous knowings can be when they get turned into knowledge. Then you have Adolf Hitler trying to destroy the whole world.
None of that messiness. So the pureness. Yeah, but the messiness
began with the impureness of Nietzsche not being willing to just live in his syphilitic sexual undesirability and trying to become eco homo, like the embodiment of the most brilliant philosopher who ever lived. Sure. How else does he become a culture maker? As opposed to him actually surrendering to the transmission and embodying it.
Meaning he wouldn't have done his
work. I mean, he did write great books, but right. So what?
Because so we're what? Talking about communication.
But he, not how well did he communicate?
Exact words. If
the Nazis were able to completely reinterpret it to their ends.
But this is the danger, right? Like, if the signal is strong, it has that much more potential to be perverted in the opposite direction.
I'm not sure if that's true.
Really?
No, I'm
not. Damn it!
Really?
I mean, I used to believe that, absolutely, 100%, like with Castaneda or something. People went mad when they read his books, so it just proves that how great they are, kind of thing.
Well, but no, having, I just think again, that everyone is a receptive being. Like, every human is an intuitive, receptive being. Some people are more aware of it than others.
Mm-hmm.
And so, like, we can talk about subconscious influence. If the signal of what Nietzsche was trying to... I mean, like, we were just talking about how words pervert the purity of the signal that he's trying to do. But in our case, this is the only way we know how to do it. We're using words to try to talk about this thing.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a science. It's imprecise. And so it can be perverted.
It can be perverted because it's imprecise?
Yeah. But there's no way around that. So
there is a way around. Well, not around that. There's a way through that. You're waiting for me to...
We are waiting. Waiting for the big answer.
I want to believe what you just said. I'm only looking at you because I want to believe what you just said.
Right.
I'm at a place where I'm not sure that I do.
Mm-hmm.
But maybe I'll get there.
Well, humility is a start.
Mm-hmm.
Like, surrender is not something that we do. That's the thing. I mean, it's not an act, surrender.
Mm-hmm.
It's a relinquishing of the need to act.
Mm-hmm.
And of the need to control. Like,
mm-hmm.
99% of our actions are geared around maintaining or gaining control of the mm-hmm. situation. So letting go of 99.9% of our actions or motivations for acting. That requires a lot of humility. Honesty, awareness, vulnerability. I mean, it's not a formula, though.
Mm-hmm.
But we're going to have to wind up pretty soon and end on the cliche, but
mm-hmm.
the medium is the message is, I think, relevant to what you've been asking here and what we're wrestling with. And when a person is embodying the soul
mm-hmm.
and transmitting the transmission. Yes, it gets compromised by language to some extent, and by other things too, but to the extent that they are embodying their soul and their truth and not expressing in order to get something or in order to exercise control,
mm-hmm.
that overcomes the thing that you were talking about, the thing that you can't get around. The compromising of the signal.
Mm.
Like, if we have the idea, it really is complicated because we have the idea of purity and impurity. In mm-hmm. a way, that's an impure mm-hmm. idea itself because mm-hmm. it's all one system, it's mm-hmm. totality. So, yeah. what's mm-hmm. impurity? Where would it come from?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It can't be. But we have the idea of impurity.
Is a perverse
idea. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And evil is an evil mm-hmm. idea, and so on, right? Satan is a satanic idea. And but, so, So what? I mean, so. What was I saying of purity? But as long as we have the idea of impurity, then that makes inescapable logic the possibility of purity, of absolute 100% purity of intent. Now, if that is a dangerous idea, of course.
Yes.
But as long as we're in that belief system, move towards what is most pure.
Mm-hmm.
Keep moving towards what is most pure, knowing that there is a total purity. Even if we reach, when we reach the total purity, we'll realize there was never any such thing as impurity.
Mm-hmm.
But we're not at that stage as yet.
Mm-hmm.
So as you're moving constantly towards what is most pure, what is most honest, what is most open.
When you move towards those things, do you feel that you are better able to pick up on the purity in other people's...
Mm-hmm. Of course, 100%.
Right.
Like judgments become less and less severe, less and less real.
Because you can just feel it immediately.
Where they're coming from.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and even if they're not coming from a good place, you can feel the place that's behind the place they're coming from that's so wounded that is why they're not coming from that place.
Mm-hmm.
So compassion would be another
mm-hmm.
core value. And you know, I'm anti-values. Mm-hmm. I don't believe in values per se, but there are expressions or movements of being that are I don't know. I'm having a difficult time putting it in words.
More organic.
There's a sort of that are more pure, that are more effective.
Yeah. I like the term organicism.
That's why sex is such a great thing for everything.
Well, a great symbol for process. Yeah. It's a great symbol for process, for sure.
It's just stripped down.
Yeah.
Well, that is a whole can of worms.
Well, yeah. I mean, in the natural, the most natural sense of, okay, maybe not humans because we're neurotic beings, but...
Being in the flow. Yes, I mean, dance would be another example.
Sure.
But dance, when you get down to anything, any sort of physical activity where we're engaged in the environment and responding to it organically, it's a response.
Yeah.
Like, the true expression is always a response.
Mm-hmm.
As long as we're in a separate experience of separate, the true expression is always a response. And I think it's bringing the response ever inward. So to respond to our environment is good, to respond to the other is good, but it's a process of bringing the response more and more inside the circle of the soul to the very center, where the response is a response to nothing external, but a response to actually the deepest core of ourselves, which is the transmission.
Mm-hmm.
And that moves us from the inside.
Yeah. All right, so
I'm content with that as a
it's a beautiful wrap up.
Monkey said to man, I want your fireman. Said to monkey, I want your brain. Monkey said to man, my desire is to be like the mankind.
So that's the end of a 1 hour and 7 minute conversation with Misty Greer and John McGuire. In the flesh, away from keyboard, in Vancouver, British Columbia. I'd like to thank G. Todd for donations this week, and you, not you the listener, but you the tree. Next week will be the Christmas podcast, but we don't really observe Christmas here in Liminopolis. Nonetheless, it will be a special Christmas podcast conversation with James Howard Kunstler, talking about everything except Christmas. I don't have anything else lined up after that. I imagine that I will keep on podcasting through the holidays, because there is no rest for the wicked. There is no downtime when you're liminal. Anything else to add? Just the usual. Donate, comment, give feedback, suggest guests, co-hosts. I know it's the season to be dreary, but definitely that goes both ways, and could use any sort of boost that come my way at this time to keep the liminal engine running. So anyway, I'm not going to wish you a happy anything, but I hope you get snow wherever you go, because it's nice.
Let's go.